I don't think AI should automate what judges do. I don't think AI should automate what juries do. And I don't think AI should replace humans completely, human lawyers in a Western liberal democracy. However, all that being said, there is a large amount of venture capital and private equity being deployed to develop true AI apps for use in the legal profession.
You're listening to Bite-Sized Business Law, where we discuss big issues in small doses. This podcast is sponsored by the Fordham University School of Law Corporate Law Center, which is run by Fordham Law Professor Richard Squire and me, your host, Amy Martella. Okay, let's get down to business.
Welcome back to Bite-Sized Business Law. Almost nothing has captured our collective attention the way the emergence of generative artificial intelligence has this past year. All we can seem to talk about is how AI is disrupting almost every industry, some more than others. Yet many of us are experiencing AI fatigue. Everyone's talking about it and writing about it and meeting about it. But fear not, because today's guest is the absolute coolest, smartest guy out there talking about AI and what we care about here at Bite-Sized Business Law. And that is the ways in which AI will revolutionize the practice of business law and impact organizations that our lawyers counsel. Bradford Newman is a partner at Baker McKenzie and chair of the firm's North America Trade Secrets Practice. Brad also chairs the ABA Subcommittee on AI. He's considered an absolute expert in the field of artificial intelligence, IP, blockchain, and crypto, and he's been extensively quoted on these matters, as well as invited to testify before the United States Senate regarding federal regulation of AI. Brad, I'm so excited for this conversation. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for that overly kind introduction. Normally, I'm just referred to as artificially intelligent, but thank you for that.
Can you give us your background? I gave a little brief background of, you know, what you're up to now, but I want to hear more about how a litigation partner ends up becoming an expert in artificial intelligence.
Sure. In the 2010 range, I had been representing the major tech companies and developers of the AI technology that everyone now knows for some time. By 2015, I got to the point where I believed, although I'm anti-regulation by DNA, that AI needed to be regulated. And so I published a thought piece in TechCrunch in 2015 outlining what I thought omnibus federal legislation should look like, because then, like now, I was concerned it would be a patchwork of local and state laws created by folks who mostly didn't understand the technology or the policies that really mattered. It may or may not have gotten a lot of attention at that point. And in 2018, I followed up with another TechCrunch article, by which time I was even more deeply immersed in this domain. And a sitting congressman's head of legislative affairs said, "Do you want to come to Washington and turn your draft bill into a House of Representatives bill?" I did do that in 2018. And it's now getting renewed interest and attention, as all of exactly what you said in the introduction. Everyone's all excited about AI, not realizing much of this technology has been around for many years, but just being deployed now. So between representing the developers and makers of this technology, being the co-chair of the ABA AI subcommittee, and being very interested in policy and being very involved in setting policy around this, is sort of who I am in this space and how I came to be talking to you today.
It's so interesting because you were coming up, it sounds like, during the dot-com bubble.
Yeah, I was in the Valley for dot-com bubble one and everything that came after. I've been in Silicon Valley for 30 years.
Like, how amazing. I mean, imagine if you were born in, you know, the 1830s, what type of lawyer you would have ended up being. You were born at the perfect time because not only are you good at it, but you have a real interest in it.
Lucky, right place, right time. I always concede I'm not the smartest person in the room, but I want to make sure the smarter people have the right information to make the right decisions and act. There is a lot of funkiness around legislating AI and who's in control of what, but we're playing with live ammunition because AI will, I always say, control our lives in a 24-hour cycle. From the moment you close your eyes to the moment you live a 24-hour cycle or go back to sleep, people are going to be data harvesters and data recipients of AI from every which way, even while asleep.
Okay. See, this is why I love you, Brad. You're just telling it like it is. So yeah, that does seem like it's something that we need to get some guardrails around. I don't like the sound of that. It doesn't sound like, you know, maybe you can say it's not going to be all bad, but it doesn't make me feel warm and fuzzy inside.
So I think people need to understand AI has great promise, especially in medical diagnostics, in making our life easier, in making our lives better. So there is a domain where AI is good. However, when really smart people with new and different technology, and I do think this is not just the cotton gin in a form of zeros and ones, I think this is transformational for humankind. And when they come knocking and say they're making the world a better place for us, we need to take a deep inhale and exhale and get very sober very quickly. Especially in a Western liberal democracy, right? In China, they can do what they want, and they have a whole different form of government and legal system and viewing the individual versus the government. But in Western liberal democracies, we better be real careful. We only have a limited window of time to study the problem and navel gaze, because pretty soon algorithms are going to be inventing algorithms and adjusting algorithms, and the human isn't going to be in the chain. So we really need to get our arms around this and do it right from a federal level, because the patchwork of state and local is vexing to innovation. We don't want to kill innovation. We want to promote innovation. And we also need to understand the world's going to be much different, and we're moving at light speed, and including the legal profession is going to be much different.
Well, that's a great segue, because I know that the data privacy folks have always for years like lamented the fact that we have this patchwork of state laws and we don't have an overarching federal framework. And you see this all the time, especially nowadays with Congress so paralyzed. What happens is the courts start stepping in and creating policy. And I'm not saying that's necessarily happened yet with AI, but there have been some really interesting examples of courts drawing lines and setting some rules. And I was wondering if you can tell us about a couple of those, starting with maybe the attorney discipline case and then the closing arguments situation.
Sure. So I'll add a third, because just last week, the California State Bar was the first one to issue ethics guidelines. They can be cited in disciplinary proceedings. They're not quite law, but it's the first bar association issuing guidance on lawyers' use of AI. But the Avianca Airlines case is the one that got all the hype. It was a personal injury case filed in New York, removed by the defendant, Avianca Airlines, to federal court. And there was a motion hearing over whether, I can't remember exactly what whether the foreign treaty allowed Avianca to be sued domestically for this claimed injury or some legal point. And the plaintiff's lawyer was not very well funded. And he did some research and lo and behold, found these six great cases that directly supported his viewpoint. He cited them to the court. He put them in the pleadings, and opposing counsel looked at them and said, we can't find them. Turns out he had used a Gen AI chatbot, asked the Gen AI chatbot, use it like, you know, we would use Lexis or Westlaw. Find me a case that says X. What is the law about Y? And Gen AI did what Gen AI did, which is hallucinate. It made up cases. And hallucination is a issue that is going to be less pronounced as Gen AI gets smarter and more billions and billions of searches are done using it and output. But right when he used it, these cases didn't exist. The other side cited to the court. The court was flabbergasted, called the lawyer in. The lawyer said, I'm a sole practitioner. There are all these extenuating circumstances. The dog ate my lunch, but I had no ill intent. He wound up being sanctioned $5,000, but he's now internet famous and there's a very bad decision. So there was that issue, which reminds lawyers, if they're going to use Gen AI, they can't use Gen AI and rely on it blindly. They have a duty of competence to understand technology, a duty of candor with a court. And a lot of courts are issuing standing orders that say, if you're using Gen AI for anything you file, you have to disclose it without waiving privilege, et cetera. You have to let the court know. So that's Avianca Airlines. You can't rely on Gen AI to do legal research at this point. That could change. The next thing you talked about was the Fugees. There was one, you know, the rap, hip hop, rock group from the 90s, early 2000s. One of them got himself in some legal trouble around donations and what he was doing with funds he raised. And he was criminally tried recently. And it turns out he was convicted. And his lawyer allegedly used Gen AI to help do the closing statement or to write him the closing statement. And it looks like the Court of Appeals in New York covering this is going to give some attention to this and maybe give him a new trial. So that goes to the duty of disclosure to the client. It also goes to, you know, I don't know what the outcome of that case will be. Using Gen AI in the law to generate ideas is actually not a bad use case. It's 2 + 2 = 4 and they get it wrong. It's more like the chatbot is ideating for the lawyer. And that alone isn't a prohibited use. It shouldn't be. I think the issue is you need to disclose it to clients. And we're getting to the point where in engagement letters, you need to disclose it to the client. The last super hot off the press development was this Cal Bar guidance issued last week to California bar lawyers and lawyers who are pro hoc admitted to practice in California. Basically, it's the same Avianca learnings with a little flourish. It says you shall not bill your client for time saved using Gen AI. So it says a lot more than that, but that's, you know, you got to keep your client informed. You have to understand what the technology is. You've got to, you know, be competent and all those sort of things. It sort of barricades the Avianca Airlines holding and rulings. So I do a lot of this teaching with judges to other judges and lawyers, to judges and other lawyers. And the ABA model rules, they already exist and account for all of these concerns. Duty to understand technology, duty to use competence in representing your client, duty to disclosure to the court, duty of candor with opposing counsel. They all sort of exist and need to be thought about, which is what are your ethical obligations as a lawyer using this? And again, the ability of what Gen AI can do for lawyers is going to continue to develop and evolve very rapidly. So lawyers who decide to use this, and there are many, need to really keep up on what their ethical obligations are.
Yeah. And I think all of these cases and the ABA rules that you're discussing in California, they all indicate what we know, which is that lawyers are using it and pretty soon it's going to become standard. So there's a lot of talk about what AI can do, what used to take attorneys, you know, could do in seconds, what used to take attorneys weeks to accomplish, you know, everything from sifting through documents and responding to discovery, making summaries for clients, even, as you said, drafting initial versions of things like briefs and closing arguments. Are there any legal tasks we're all hoping, right? All these lawyers are hoping. Are there any legal tasks that you don't see AI being able to automate?
I don't think AI should automate what judges do. I don't think AI should automate what juries do. And I don't think AI should replace humans completely, human lawyers in a Western liberal democracy. However, all that being said, there is a large amount of venture capital and private equity being deployed to develop true AI apps for use in the legal profession. I think the legal profession and big laws, we know it, and you know, mid-sized law firms are going to need less humans to do the things that humans do now. They will always need lawyers proficient in AI technologies and maybe with engineering backgrounds or computer science backgrounds. And you're still, I think, going to need humans to do the representation of the client in court and all of the things that lead to that. As far as M&A deals and transactional work, AI may have a larger place in that. We are going to get to the point where it's like, make me an M&A deal for this transaction, and a pretty close facsimile to the final will come out. So you're going to need less people. There's going to be AI tracking regulations, AI tracking everything in the law. So there's going to be less humans, more technology, but still a place for lawyers who understand the technology to practice law in America.
So as many of our listeners know, when you're a very junior associate, you do a lot of these types of tasks. I mean, looking back at when I was in big law, I mean, I could salivate thinking about how nice it would have been to have had a large language model type of AI for things like doc review. So when we were at this beer roundtable, we were speaking, you said something that really shocked me, which is you think there may not be a whole lot of space for junior associates going forward. Tell me more about that.
Yeah, that is true. One of the most obvious applications of true AI, and one's interestingly courts encourage, when you have mass amounts of data to be sifted through is that the parties agree on a tool to use it and to run it on the system and thereby save money, save time, get over this issue of, well, there's too much data to review. Junior associates are already viewed with a negative eye by many clients. Many clients say, we don't want any lawyer who's not a fourth or fifth year billing on our file. They don't know what they're doing. They're inefficient, et cetera, et cetera. Paralegals and special, you know, you can't practice law without a license, but there'll be specialists who can run these tools on data sets and give the results back. If I were a junior associate or going to be a junior associate in big law, I would definitely make sure I'm familiar with AI, understand AI, and I can be one of the ones that have a place in this future market because I could make myself more valuable by helping understand the technology and the tool and how it's run. But just the days of hanging out in a conference room with four junior associates sifting through documents, those days are nearly gone and will be soon, as will a lot of the tasks juniors that find me a case that says X. All that stuff's going to go away.
Yeah, I was reading about this tool called CoCounsel, which is like an AI tool dedicated to ask the types of questions you would ask a junior associate.
Yep. And they're having a moment. You'll be hearing a lot more of it. The market will be hearing a lot more about them.
Oh, really? Okay. Interesting. But I mean, if that's the case, then how does any young lawyer ever even get to the level of being a seasoned associate or partner? How will they ever amass the experience that gives them that irreplaceable instinct or those seasoned lawyers have?
Yeah. So great question. I think it'll be analogous to what we have now. Most junior associates, I don't want to be pejorative, they don't wash out. They just find that the system's not right for them and they're not right for the system. There will always be one or two in every class that show ingenuity and drive and that they have the tool set and get it, and they become valuable. There's just going to be a need for less. So summer classes aren't going to be as big, and there's going to be a quicker churn. If the system doesn't work for you and you don't work for the system, it'll be obvious, you'll be out. But for the lawyers who have the ingenuity to make themselves useful, to spot things algorithms aren't trained to spot, to form relationships with the humans in the law firm to add value, there still will be a place for humans in the law, just less of them according to a different leverage model than we have now. If anyone thinks differently, I'd love to debate them. Because, I mean, there are people out there like, oh, this is the cotton gin. And oh, the mechanization of machinery created new jobs. And yeah, I'd love to debate that person because I think it's not the way it's going to be.
Yeah, I totally agree. This is not, you know, television taking over radio. This is a completely different thing. I know I often fantasize about going back to this like old fashioned lawyering. I listened a lot to Adam Grant. He's this behavioral psychologist. He's the one who went viral during COVID with a New York Times article about languishing. But he had this great comparison where he was talking about how, you know, it's always been our humans' cognitive abilities that have separated us from animals, right? But that's what AI is taking over and surpassing, if it not has already, our cognitive abilities. So really going forward, it'll be our character skills that separate us from machines. So what does that mean for lawyers, right? It's going to be that relationship building, that advocating, orating skills. Like when you went down probably to DC and spoke to the Senate, being able to convince really and to persuade are those kind of intangible skills that I think lawyers might come back to actually. And maybe we'll have this like crop of really amazing lawyers. And like you said, everyone else will kind of have to find another industry.
You raise a great point. And, you know, clients are humans. You know, young lawyers always say, well, how do I get clients? First, be a person. Clients hire people they like, right? Why does one client hire you and another client hires me? It's relationships. It's judgment. It's a confidence that they get from you telling them in their moment of need. And it's not always litigation. It could be transactional, big deal coming up or a bankruptcy or whatever it is. They go to their trusted advisors, humans. I don't think it's ever going to, I shouldn't say ever, but it's going to be a while till it gets to a point where general counsel of Xco is a bot hiring an outside law firm that's a bot, and the bots just interact with each other and then file something with a judge who's a bot. You know, that would be a sad day.
God, I hope not. So you know, you gave some really good advice for law students, people looking to come into the profession. What's your advice for law schools? I know that at business schools, they're adding courses like prompt generation. And are there, you know, have you thought about the types of courses that we should be adding to the law school curriculum?
So without being terribly controversial, the law schools have a desire to admit as many students as can pay the tuition to join. So law schools certainly don't have any incentive to narrow the number of new students who are admitted, which is good if you want to go to law school. So like AI is not going to shut the door to law schools. Law schools are going to stay open. But your question is the right question. What should law schools be teaching? Technology in the law, AI in the law should be a mandatory first year class. Because remember, lawyers are the only licensed professionals who go to school for a period of years and come out and don't know how to apply their tool, their trade. Like doctors can operate by the time they're out of med school and residency, et cetera. And accountants know GAAP and how to read a financial statement. Law students come out and they really don't have the skills to practice law. So hard skills training, making law school more a technical exercise and making it less theoretical because, you know, IRAC issue, I don't even remember what IRAC stands for, issue, review.
Rule, analysis, conclusion. Yeah.
Yeah, whatever that is. That's going to be a bot task. It's going to be what a law student or a young lawyer can get the right questions. It isn't, did the bot pull the cases? It's, did we ask the bot to pull the right cases? Why aren't we focusing on that? Or, you know, new issue. We think we've got, our client has these five issues. The bot gave us the case law. What about a sixth issue nobody thought about? Because remember, to an extent, we certainly don't have general AI. Bots are garbage in, garbage out. In this law domain, they're still going to need humans to guide them for a while. Now, it could get to a point where you have near general AI, not generative AI, where, you know, the client dictates their problem. The bot analyzes it as good as all the human minds could on Earth and displace humans almost all entirely. That's conceivable. I'm not ruling that out. It's just a ways away, if ever.
Wow.
But okay. Don't despair.
No. Well, yeah, don't despair. Well, now I just also want to ask you about something, another shocking proposition you gave us at a different presentation. And that related more to the business world, right? So it seems like you think that AI will have a huge impact on kind of like the prominence of business in society. And you mentioned something about getting to the point where there's a very small number of corporations that basically run the world. Tell us about that theory.
So first of all, we're probably already there with data sets, accepting the open source data sets that are available, you know, and they're open source that exists. But the true data sets are maintained by, you know, less than 10 companies. The most valuable data sets, what you eat, what you watch, how much you walk a day, where you drive, how long it takes you, what do you do once you're there? All of this sort of analytics is controlled by a very small number of companies in the West and even smaller amount in China. And you need to be asking the question, especially in a Western liberal democracy, is that a good thing or a bad thing? And I do think that there are tech companies that want to be what I call extra sovereigns. They see themselves as nation states, unconstrained. Like, what does the U.S. border mean, or Mexico, or Canada? What does that mean if every single person in Canada, Mexico, U.S., Latin America, Europe is on our platform every day for 4 hours a day looking at the same content? It starts not to matter in many ways. We, tech company, transcend national boundaries and can serve up the same data or any type of data we want anywhere in the world, except where it might be blocked for geopolitical reasons. That's a lot of power. And we make bargains, right? When we do searches, we made a bargain. No one's charging us, but we're giving up a lot of our individual privacy and information. And humans love free and easy and quick. So I personally don't think it's a good thing if you look at, you think about your children and your children's children, that a very, very small number of companies control all the data of who we are and what we do as humans. Because for obvious reasons, that's going to be easy to exploit for the benefit of a few to the detriment of all of us.
Mm-hmm. It's scary too, because, you know, you and I and people in our generation kind of have that mindset of, you know, this really isn't normal. We need to protect data. We need to protect privacy in general. But I see it with my kids. Like, they don't have the same thoughts about privacy. So everything they do is at all times open to everyone to see and view. And my son will be like, oh, my friend Liam sent me, you know, from his Apple Watch, how much he slept last night. They don't even care about privacy. So I wonder how that'll play out in the future.
I sometimes play a mental game with myself where I look at everybody I come in contact with when I leave my house. Gas station attendants, baristas, people at the supermarket, at the mall, you know, everywhere I go. And I just know in 5 to 10 years, those people aren't going to have jobs and many won't have a reentry into the workforce. So what are we going to do as a society? And you already see it in the airport, right? The Amazon stores exist, but now in the airport, there's self-checkout. Where did the jobs go? Well, there's still somebody stalking, someone making sure you don't steal. Soon that's going to be on. The whole thing's going to be automated. So there's going to be jobs that go away and don't come back. In the law, the goal for young lawyers is to ensure that they are adding value for their clients in a way that a machine can't completely replace them. So that's it.
Right. I know. I often think about, I'm like, I feel like we're going to have this in-person economy, right? Where it's like, no one has a job unless it's that type of irreplaceable in-person interaction, live performance art, right? Caregiving and relationship building, like you said, in certain industries, like in the law.
COVID was a good example of the valuation of tech stock stored because we were sitting home on our phones, on our computers, not leaving the house, buying things, looking at things, clicking through things. That might be a lot of the future world. And then how does that affect our mental health, our physical health? How are we going to be a human being that doesn't find any worth in a job where we earn money because there aren't any for our skill sets? You know, these are the larger questions of just how deep AI is going to change things. But for the law, I know judges are also worried AI is going to be deployed in a way that's unfair to lower income litigants, to game juries, to game judges and how they might decide cases. There's all sorts of stuff, but the law is definitely going to be a different animal in 5 years and 10 years because of AI.
Yeah. And a lot of people have said, oh, you know, make sure your kids are becoming programmers and coders because the only people who have jobs are those who can create the AI. But as you mentioned, you know, we're going to get to a point where AI is creating the AI. So you have to just know how to harness it and know how it can complement your work as a lawyer and use it to the best of your abilities in that way. I mean, right? Isn't the AI going to write the algorithms eventually?
They are. They're going to repair algorithms and humans are going to be a judge or regulator may say to the best data scientists in the world, how did this happen? And their true answer might be, nobody knows. We don't know. It's a lot. We've lost track.
So what happens to all those jobs? Are we going to Andrew Yang's universal basic income model?
I mean, my belief is that, I don't want to say people farms, but the way we live is going to be different because there's going to be nothing for a lot of people to do when they wake up in the morning. There'll be no job for them to go to and they won't be alone. So society's going to have to figure out, you just can't have a large number of people with no purpose doing nothing. It's deteriorating to the fabric of the social contract and will lead to social and economic and, you know, unrest. So we're going to have to figure this out as a society, as if the predictions occur and there's a mass loss of jobs with no chance of reentry into the workplace. You're going to have to figure out what are we going to do with people who lost their job as a clerk or a barista or a shelf stalker, and there's no job waiting for them. No truck driver job. There's no loading a truck or, you know, if you go to Japan or some big warehouses here, a lot of stuff's already automated by a machine doing what many humans used to do. These are tough questions. Tough questions.
So, but Brad, these are such existential questions. You were down there testifying before the Senate. How does the government start getting its arms around it? Like little by little, I'm assuming, right? Baby steps. Do you feel that they're ready to start putting some guardrails around the use of AI?
I think my desire is to make sure that the right people hear the right things about technology, law, and policy. If you leave it to politics, the usual suspects, organized labor, special interest groups, are going to come and do a number, and we're going to get really bad legislation. So I want to make sure that there's a pro-innovation, pro-Western liberal democracy bent to whatever's enacted, and it's not some onerous, anti-innovative, bad policy. I want good policy. This is too important not to have good policy around.
It'll be interesting to see whether this is an issue that's debated in, you know, the upcoming election cycle, because if you can speak to this issue intelligently and fairly, I feel like you automatically have a leg up. But I don't know, maybe the American people, you know, aren't ready to hear all of the big existential questions that are out there.
Or, you know, look, if it's Trump v. Biden, I don't think either one of them are going to go in there. If it's Gavin Newsom versus somebody else, then you just got to listen carefully to the words being spoken, because politicians usually get it wrong, and it's our job as society to help steer them to get it right. So it'll be interesting. I do think Congress is going to pass some AI legislation shortly. I do think it'll be in the employment domain first. It's easier to get your arms around, and then ultimately IP, and then ultimately in other areas of our lives, privacy, data, etc.
That's great to hear. Do you think the EU will like beat us to the punch as it usually does with regulation for AI?
Yeah, but the EU regulation's turning into a hot mess and special interests. They just had a trilogue meeting that was supposed to solve some things, and there was issues over law enforcement's use of facial recognition, self-determining whether your system's high risk versus having an outsider do that. They're hung up on a lot of issues. And whatever comes out of the Brussels is going to be pretty onerous and anti-innovative, in my view. So there'll be good aspects to it, but it won't be portable over here.
Well, Brad, we are so grateful to have you here in the U.S. advocating for us. I know you're a very busy guy. I can't thank you enough for taking the time to speak with us, and for your advice for young lawyers, as well as your wisdom on this incredibly important issue.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks to everyone at Fordham Law School, especially the Dean's Office and our Corporate Law Center donors for supporting this podcast. Bite-Sized Business Law is produced by We Edit Podcasts. Listen and subscribe to Bite-Sized Business Law on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. The information in this podcast is for educational, informational, and entertainment purposes only and does not constitute legal advice, nor is it intended to promote the organizations with which our guests are affiliated. For more information, check out our show notes, and thanks for listening.